The ever-curious gardener is described as an irreverent romp through the natural science of plants and soil, ideal for newer gardeners moving beyond back-of-the-seed-pack planting to experienced gardeners whose curiosity at the wonders of cultivation grows deeper and stronger with each season. Today, Lee Reich, the author of The Ever-Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden, is my guest. Welcome to the show, Lee.
Thanks for having me.
Your list of credentials is large and would lead one to think, coming from academia, you would really not be that funny, but you are.
Thanks.
The Ever-Curious Gardener really is delightfully readable to the layman. Was that a part of your goal, kind of reaching out to those who simply love to play in the dirt, so to speak?
Well, that's always been my goal, because coming from academia, you know, there's a lot of research and new things that come out, and I always felt like one of my jobs was to translate what's important, and not everything's important. There's a lot of, in my opinion, research that's not worth doing, but to translate that which is important into some practical things that gardeners can actually do out in their garden.
And, you know, as you mention that things change, and one of the big things that I noticed, I am a gardener and I have a garden blog and that sort of thing as well, and a radio show, I noticed the change from, like, wound dressing for trees and tilling. Tilling has been a big one. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know you do in your book, why we should not till.
Well, that's been one of my pet peeves for a long time. I actually, well, one thing that it sort of attracts me to this is when I was a senior in high school, my English teacher used the word iconoclast, and then he defined it meaning literally image breaker or smasher, and that really sort of resonated with me. So I always like to debunk things if they're worth debunking. And one thing is, gardeners and farmers have always tilled their land, and, you know, it was the mark of a good gardener or farmer how nicely tilled it was. And then I had started some reading many, many years ago about the benefits of not tilling. So I tried it, and I actually came up with a system that works quite well. I haven't tilled my vegetable gardens in over 30 years.
That is
and
wonderful.
Basically, the advantages are, one big advantage is you have less weeds. And another book that I wrote was called Weedless Gardening, or is called Weedless Gardening. And one of the main things in the book is not tilling, because when you till, you bring up weed seeds that are buried within every soil and expose them to light, and that's what they're just waiting for, to germinate.
Yeah.
So that's one thing, one reason not to till. Another thing is it. Most gardeners know that organic matter or humus is good in the soil. The more you have, the better. It's one of those few things in life you can't have too much of. So when you till the soil, you actually charge it with so much oxygen that it actually burns up the organic matter too quickly, which initially makes plants grow better, because as it burns up, nutrients are released. But eventually it just burns it all out, so there's, there's not enough left, and it's sort of like taking money out of a bank faster than putting it back in. So that's another reason not to till. Also, you get better the soil structure. You know, obviously, earthworms don't like to be tilled up.
No.
And fungi, they have all these fine hyphae going through, or threads, fungal threads going through the soil. That they don't like that either. And so, you know, when a soil is untilled but not compacted, just left alone, it gets this sort of crystalline structure where you have all different sized pore spaces. And when you till, you sort of discombobulate that. And you actually get better water efficiency by not tilling. The water can move and be held in the soil better.
So,
and then I always like to mention the final reason.
Yes.
Not to till, and that's because you don't have to till then.
Very good point. And what's interesting is, then why did we begin to do that in the first place?
I think initially it was just, I mean, I know initially it was just to make a place where you can sow seeds, you know, so
just make
a stick
it easy.
Or something like that. But then I think humans, in so many other ways, they get better and better at this, so they got so efficient at it with, you know, rototillers and such implements, that rototillers, plows, that they got so good at it that really it was overdone too easily. It's sort of like sweet corn. It used to be people were always trying to see how sweet corn can be.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came up with, you know, about 50 years ago or more, the super sweet corns, which to me, I know a lot of people like them, so it's a matter of opinion, but mm-hmm. I personally don't like them. And so there's no trouble getting them sweet, and they're many times sweeter than traditional sweet corns, which I happen to like. They're not as sweet, but they're richer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just people got too good at tilling, at preparing the soil, that they tilled it so much that it there were bad results.
Yeah.
I mean, one bad result in the Midwest was, of course, the Dust Bowls of the 1930s, because those soils were very rich in organic matter, and constant tillage burned up all that organic matter till nothing was holding the soil particles together.
Yeah, and you would have thought we'd have learned by then, or because of that, but apparently
not.
Well,
there's a big push. You know, a lot of gardeners
and
more over the years don't till, and even on farm scales, a lot of people don't till. There's a local farmer where I live who hasn't, and he's a commercial farmer, small farmer. But he hasn't tilled for about 20 years.
We have one here as well, and he is a commercial farmer, small commercial farmer, who hasn't tilled for years, and he is in several articles and speaks on the subject as well. So at least it's out there, and we keep trying. We're talking with Lee Reich. He is the author of The Ever Curious Gardener, and, you know, up in this area, I live in the upper Midwest, we can experience really hot, dry weather. And as you'd mentioned, not tilling does help with soil moisture. What are some of the other things that we can do to help our plants thrive through drought?
Well, one thing is by not over-fertilizing. These plants are growing very lushly. They're not, you know, they just can't handle drought as well because they're giving off a lot of water and they're very succulent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the most important things is a good watering technique. You know, people, I have a friend that he once called me up and he said, you know, what's wrong with my plant? You know, it's not doing well. So I said, you're probably underwatering it. So he said, no, I water it all the time. So I said, well, then you're probably overwatering it. He said, I also do consulting. He said, you get paid to say things like that? but good, correct watering, you know, the right amount at the right time is crucial. And, you know, if you use a sprinkler, I mean, I know I sometimes see people, they have a sprinkler set up to go on every single day, say on a lawn or a shrub border.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's worse than a waste of water. It also is not good for the plants. It promotes diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So a good rule of thumb is to water the equivalent of 1 inch of rainfall or 1 inch of depth of water once a week.
Yeah.
And people are surprised at first, but the ultimate, and I mentioned this in the book, I think is to go with if any part of the garden needs regular watering, and I say that just because not every plant needs regular watering. You know, if you're growing, say, a sort of a wildflower type garden with the purple cone flowers and liatris, things like that, these aren't plants that really need lush conditions. And if you water them, they're just going to grow, so they probably won't make as many flowers. They'll grow more leaves, but you also encourage weeds that do like those conditions. So back to if there's any part of the garden that does need regular watering, what I recommend is drip irrigation, and it's been around for, you know, 70 years or so.
Yeah.
And in California, it's very popular because they basically, parts of California don't have, when things are going as they should, they don't have rain from May to October, but, you know, often they have worse droughts. So they've been using drip irrigation for a long time, and I use it in my vegetable gardens. I only drip irrigate two things, vegetables and my blueberries, because blueberries really do like that condition. And, you know, and the theory is, you know, if you picture a drippy faucet and there's a nice green plant under it, that's drip irrigation in theory. Mm. But
With your blueberries, since you brought that up, what how do you acidify the soil for those?
Oh, also covered in my book.
That's, yes.
people up in, I think that's one of the most important things with blueberries. is to get the soil right. Because if you don't get the soil right, then they don't grow enough. And since they bear fruit on one-year-old stems, if they don't make enough growth this year, next year there's not enough stem growth to hang fruit on. So the way you get the soil right, basically one of the most important things is make the soil more acidic. Or not, no, I shouldn't say, make it so it's the correct acidity, which would be very acidic, a pH of 4 to 5.5 or so. And the way you do that is you take a soil test, and then if it's too alkaline, which I guess is quite common in the upper Midwest.
Yes, it is.
Then if it's too alkaline, you know, some people figure they're going to dig in peat moss or add oak leaves or pine needles. Those things don't really acidify the soil permanently or long-term or quickly enough or sufficiently enough. And the way you do it is with sulfur, which actually is just a naturally mined mineral. It's elemental sulfur. They dig it up, and it's often powdered to use as a fungicide. It's a fungicide that's been used for like 2,000 years, but it can also be added to the soil. And for soil use, the best thing is to use what's called pelletized sulfur. It's compressed into little, looks like little lentils. And that just makes it easier to spread. It's the same material. And you, and depending on what, how much of a pH change you need it, is needed, and what kind of soil you have, because it takes more sulfur to change the pH in a clay soil than a sandy soil, that determines how much sulfur to add.
And as we, thank you, and as we go through, it's, well, some people say we're not experiencing a climate change, but we are. We are. Talk to us about the microclimates and how we might use those as things change. And does it seem like everything's changing? Well, it is changing a lot faster, so we have to be a little bit more proactive on that?
Yeah, this is one of the points I make in my book, that so it's about using natural science for a better garden. And not only a better garden, but a more resilient garden, so that you can adapt. You know what's going on, so you can adapt your gardening techniques or the plants you grow to the changes. And one way, as I pointed out, was that you can look to microclimate, which is small pockets of climate that are different from the general climate. For instance, near the south side of your house, it's going to be a little warmer, because the house will absorb heat and the sunlight beams down on that south side. On the north side of the house, things will be a little cooler, which you'd think would be bad in the upper Midwest, but say if you're growing things like peaches, right, which I guess are sort of chancy up there anyway.
Yes.
But if you have something that blooms early, that can then experience late frost, you would want to plant it near, on the north side of a slope, or on the north side of a house, so that the winter sun doesn't warm it up, and then finally, when it's summertime, the sun can hit that area, but it'll delay blossoming and increase the chances for getting fruit.
Right.
In that case,
yeah.
Or there are some you know, plants that generally like cooler conditions. I was trying to grow once as a poppy called the blue poppy.
Oh yeah,
and I had heard about it about 25 years ago. Somebody described to me as the most clearest blue imaginable. That this person who described said he saw it in England from across a pond.
Oh,
and
wow.
Ever since then, I always wanted to grow it. I'd never seen it, but I wanted to grow it. So I finally got seeds for it, and I sowed the seeds. And I know it's native to where there's cool summers. It doesn't like a lot of heat, so I kept it on the east side of my house. It gets a little morning sun, and then it's hidden from the sun. I figured this would be a little cooler. So it grew really well, and then July came about, and it was super hot, even on the east side of my house, and the plant just collapsed dead.
Oh.
So I finally gave up, unless I'm going to have a refrigerated greenhouse or something. I'm not going to grow blue poppy, although I did get to see it once. I went to a botanical garden, and they happened to be in that town at a time where the blue poppies, what they did is they had them, the plants shipped from Alaska in fall, and then they kept them in a cooler or something. Yeah, in a cooler, and then they put them in this conservatory to blossom in late winter.
Amazing.
And they had this big show with them, and it was definitely worth seeing.
Oh, yeah.
But unfortunately, I'm not going to try and grow it again.
But isn't that fascinating how something like a blue poppy can be so tough and hard to grow, and then all of a sudden you're growing a tangerine tree in your potted plant?
Right. Yeah. So I just threw a seed next to this rocking chair. I was eating a tangerine at one point, and woke up to the kitchen to throw away the seed. I just threw it in the pot of a houseplant, and it sprouted. But that also highlights how easy citrus are to grow from seed.
Yeah, which I guess, and you know, us up in the upper Midwest, we kind of feel like it's a little bit harder for us to grow anything like that, and you know, so there you go.
Well, indoors.
Yeah. Indoors.
I actually lived in Wisconsin for quite a while, and I tried a number of tropical plants. The first plant that I ever, when I got into gardening, I had an apartment, and I thought it'd be cool to have figs.
So I got
a fig tree, and I had it in a pot. And now what I know about figs, it's obvious why I never got a fig from that tree. Because abundant sunlight and heat, and this was sort of a not very bright window in an apartment.
Yeah.
Certain plants, is one of my regrets. I live in a fairly cold area, not as cold as Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
But, I regret not being able to grow citrus in quantity. I do have potted citrus in the house now, and I do get fruit from them.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, right about 3 feet from my nose is a citrus in bloom, which is quite nice.
Oh, I'll bet. How lovely. And how much fun do you have playing? I mean, because really, your research, I understand, and that, but it's really sort of play, you know?
I actually used that very word yesterday, because I was telling somebody how I love this time of year, because I'm out in the garden all the time, but it's like, you know, like constant. Like every time I go outside, it's like I can do any one of 10 things, and then once I finish that, it's another 10. And so I say that I was out working in the garden, but that really doesn't sound right.
You know.
That I'm working in the garden. It really is playing. Of course, it's not really playing either, but.
Yeah, but it feels like it.
It's fun.
Yes.
It's fun.
It is.
Yeah.
It really is. And for us, I feel like when I talk to people about gardening, I feel like up here it's extreme gardening because, the spring we barely had one, really. And then it went to 80 degrees. We had 2 feet We had a foot of snow a week before we had 80 degrees.
Right.
And, yeah.
Right. I know that because I'm actually in the Hudson Valley in New York, for some reason our weather always follows yours by about 2 days. So we didn't have a foot of snow, but there was some snow here,
mm-hmm.
and it was a very cool, cool spring. And now it's like today it's probably 80 something outside.
Yeah, crazy.
And it's really quite beautiful. One thing nice about it is it delayed blossoming. I grow a lot of fruit trees.
Mm-hmm.
So it delayed blossoming all the fruit trees so that they weren't threatened by late frost. And now everything sort of blossomed at once.
Yeah.
It's really quite a spectacular sight. And and I think we're pretty much past severe frost, so I have high hopes, as I do every year.
Yes.
For fruits.
You have to have high hopes, otherwise you're not going to do it.
Right.
Well, Lee, thank you so much for your time. The book is The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. And I would highly suggest folks get this book. There's so much information. I mean, we just skimmed along the path of a curious gardener. So I would highly recommend it. And again, I appreciate your time, and I hope I get a chance to talk to you again. Do you have another book coming out?
I'm in recovery from this book.
I'll bet. Well, enjoy your gardening, and thanks again for your time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
All right.